The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society. The Korea Society, in 2007, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. On August 8, 2007, Donald P. Gregg, chairman of the Korea Society, gave a lecture entitled Two Koreas, Past and Present, to a group of educators assembled for one of the Society's regular teachers' courses on Korea. Gregg, who served as U.S. ambassador to South Korea from 1989 to 1993, recounted the complex history of America's relationship with the Korean Peninsula, including its role in the division of the two Koreas in 1945. Gregg also spoke about the movement by North and South Korea towards rapprochement and what that might mean for their respective futures.
Thank you, Evans, and welcome. I'm glad you are all here. I'm glad you didn't get flooded out or otherwise inconvenienced by coming here. Evans mentioned that I spent a long time with CIA, and last week, I just finished reading a new book on CIA called Legacy of Ashes, which is, I think, probably the best book ever written on the agency. It's highly critical, but I think it's very fair. It's written by a man named Tim Weiner, whom I have known and dealt with and find him very, very fair. And in the book, he uses a line which I gave him. He actually doesn't give me credit for it, but it is my line, and that is that North Korea is the longest-running failure in the history of American espionage. And I can say that because I was really part of that failure for a good deal of my time in Asia. I joined the agency in 1951 during the Korean War. I trained Koreans during the war, some of whom were killed in operations against North Korea. I served as station chief in Seoul, we got nowhere in terms of operations against the North Koreans. And when I went back as ambassador later on, we weren't very much farther along. Why was that? Well, the North Koreans were very hard to get at. They were sometimes approachable in a place like Chad or Niger or some very difficult place where talking to an American might get them some scotch whiskey or something like that. But once they went back to Pyongyang, they were just dropped out of sight. So I've told the North Koreans this. I've been to North Korea four times. The North Koreans knew a lot more about me than I knew about them. And in fact, when I was ambassador to South Korea, they used to drop leaflets denouncing me. And one of those leaflets is one of my proudest possessions. It's really very well done and accuses me of plotting the death of Kim Il-sung, a subsequent president of South Korea. And so I have a long history with North Korea, but I feel that it's extremely important that the United States gets it off the axis of evil, where it never should have been in the first place, and that we score a breakthrough in our relations with North Korea, because I feel very strongly that once the Soviet Union collapsed, the Cold War ended, North Korea's number one goal has really been to establish a strategic relationship with the United States. I also have a lot of a feeling of latent responsibility in dealing with North Korean issues, because I feel we have a responsibility as a country for the situation on the Korean Peninsula that goes a long, long way back. We Americans are basically ahistoric. We are interested in what has happened to us as a people. And when we start an interaction with another people, as we did with Korea in 1950, when North Korea invaded South Korea, Our essential judgment was that Korean history began on the 25th of June, 1950. Well, tell that to a Korean. They are very proud of the fact that they can trace their people back, they say, 5,000 years. And this ignorance on our part is very convenient in a way, because there are some things we have done in the past in terms of interaction with the Koreans which really help set the stage for the situation that we have been dealing with since the division of Korea at the end of World War II. The first Americans, I think, to really have meaningful interaction with North Korea were men on a steamship named the Sherman, which, taking advantage of very high tide, got up the Taedong River right into the center of Pyongyang shortly after the end of the Civil War. And the ship was American. The crew was not entirely American, although I guess the officers were American. And none of them survived the voyage, so it's not really quite clear what they did to annoy the North Koreans. The North Koreans make mention of such things as grave robbing and annoying Korean women. And the Pyongyang was noted at that time as the home of the most beautiful kiseng in Korea. In any case, whatever the men on the Sherman did, it annoyed the North Koreans, who tried to attack the ship. It had modern guns, and the North Koreans were driven off. But then the tides went out, and the Sherman ran aground. And the North Koreans, using fire rafts, burned the ship to the waterline and killed every man in the crew. And there's a monument on the banks of the Taedong River celebrating this naval victory over the United States, right beside the Pueblo, the intelligence ship of the United States Navy that the North Koreans seized in 1968. So as far as the North Koreans are concerned, in terms of naval warfare, they're leading 2-0. Their memories of the fighting in the Korean War are very different. We use napalm against them for the first time. They are very much aware that MacArthur wanted to drop a cordon of nuclear weapons across the neck of the Korean Peninsula, and so they have had a very deep fear of our use of nuclear weapons against them, which I think is one of the reasons they have worked so hard to develop nuclear weapons of their own. So then switching back to the 1870s, the United States had succeeded in opening up Japan when Commodore Perry in 1857 steamed into Tokyo Bay with a large flotilla of ships. But Korea was resisting this kind of overture from the United States. They called themselves the Hermit Kingdom. And so the United States decided that it wanted to open up Korea. So a very powerful squadron of ships was sent out to Korea in the 1870s, and they basically shot their way into Korea. They went up the entrance to the Han River, destroying several forts around the entrance, which had been sufficiently strong to fend off a French attack. But they killed 200 or 300 Korean defenders of those forts, and steamed up toward Chemulpo, which was Incheon, and then sent a deputation to the king, and Korea was opened up. So this was a forceful opening up. Korea has been the cockpit of fighting in Northeast Asia, and if you look at a map, you'll see why. It's right in the middle. The Sino-Japanese War started in Korea in 1895. The Russo-Japanese War started in Korea in 1905, and that brings me to another very unhappy intersection between the United States and Korea. It came when Teddy Roosevelt won the first Nobel Peace Prize for the United States by bringing an end to the Russo-Japanese War through the Treaty of Portsmouth, signed in Portsmouth, New Hampshire in 1905, or 1906, I'm not sure of the year. there was a secret codicil to that treaty called the Taft-Katsura Pact. And under that agreement, we said to the Japanese, do anything you want with Korea, but don't mess with us in the Philippines. And so that gave the Japanese a free hand to annex Korea and declare it to be part of Japan, which they did in 1910. And there followed thereafter a brutal 35-year occupation by the Japanese, in which the speaking of Korean was discouraged. The names of the cities were changed. Seoul became Keijo, which is a Japanese word. Anybody who objected to that was treated very, very severely. A very difficult, brutal 35-year period. And not one in a million Americans knows about the Taft-Katsura Pact. Every Korean school child knows about it. And they feel that it was a rotten piece of diplomacy and on our part, and I fully agree with them. Then the last thing we did, which every Korean knows about, is because we'd made no real provision to accept the surrender of the Japanese army, which was occupying Korea at the time at the end of World War II, we had done everything that we could to encourage the Soviet Union to attack Japan. The Soviets had waited very cleverly until after we had dropped our first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. They then invaded. They went into Manchuria, began to dismantle the industrial complex there, and were heading toward the Korean Peninsula. And it suddenly dawned on us that we had absolutely no way of stopping a Soviet advance down the Korean Peninsula, which would put them right at the in Busan, looking right down our throats in Japan. We had come to realize by that time that the Soviets were a very questionable ally. And so somebody had the bright idea of drawing a line at the 38th parallel, saying to the Soviets, okay, you can occupy the northern half of Korea, but leave us alone in the south. The Koreans were not consulted on that, and it was a 10-minute decision. Dean Rusk, who was later Secretary of State under Dulles, said it was a 10-minute decision made with a National Geographic Society map. And the Koreans, who had been looking forward to the end of the Japanese campaign, suddenly found themselves with a new occupier in the northern half of the peninsula, the Soviet Union, who brought with them their chosen leader for North Korea, Kim Il-sung. And so the stage was set for the hostility between North and South Korea, and the stage was set for the starting of the war in 1950. Now, all of these things I've told you are known very widely in Korea. You are one of a handful of Americans in New York City who's been told all this. And so when the South Koreans do something that we don't really approve of, the average American will say, well, aren't they grateful for saving us in 1950? Or for our having saved them in 1950? And, the older Koreans who suffered during the war, are still very grateful for Truman's intervention. But younger Koreans, born since that time and fully aware of the full extent of American relations with Korea, are not particularly grateful to us, because they say if it hadn't been for Taft-Katsura, if it hadn't been for the division of the Korean Peninsula in 1945, we wouldn't have this situation. So history is a very important thing to know, and so I'm very glad to tell you this this about the Korean Peninsula. Let me take as an aside to say how much I admire people like you who've gone into teaching. I do quite a lot of talking at universities around the country, and my theme is that there's a major fork in the road, young college graduates are deciding what they're going to do, one road leads to affluence and the other road leads to pertinence. And if you're getting out of college with a lot of educational loans, affluence sounds pretty good because it means you can pay your college loans off sooner. But let me tell you, as one who spent 43 years working for the government, and you don't get rich working for the government, pertinence holds up magnificently as a lifelong motivation. Affluence does not. So when I talk to young college students, I use that metaphor. And I urge them to consider public service. What do I mean by public service? Teaching is a public service. Government work, CIA, if you will, or the Department of State, is another form of public service. But you are clearly public servants. We are far better off for having you and for having you do what you are doing. And I am just, that's why I always take the opportunity to speak to groups like you, because I think it's, what you do is so important and often far too underappreciated. So back to Korea, the divided Korea. By the way, if I say anything particularly outrageous or provocative that you want to ask a question during my talk, please stick up your hand. I will stop toward the end of the hour so that we can take questions. But if there's something you want to ask me as we talk, don't hesitate to interrupt. The relations between the divided Korean countries was very tough. In the early days, when the division was made, and in the early times, in the 40s, North Korea was vastly more powerful economically than South Korea. The Italian peninsula and the Korean peninsula are very similar. In the northern ends of both peninsulas, you have water power, you have mineral resources, and you have an industrial tradition. In the south is the breadbasket. And so when it became clear that we were only going to be dealing with the southern half of the Korean peninsula, the American army and the American aid people were looking north at a much more formidable half of the country, and the term economic basket case was originated in South Korea. Now the South Korean economy is something like 20 times larger than the North Korean economy. The Korean economic recovery, the entrepreneurial spirit that has emerged in South Korea has been tremendous, but that's not the way it was in the beginning. And the fear of an attack from the North was palpable. When I was there as chief of station for CIA in 1973 to 75, there was a curfew at night. Broad fairways on golf courses had holes for big poles to be stuck in at sunset so that North Korean gliders or AN-12s could not land at night to land troops of saboteurs. In 1968, the North Koreans sent a troop of men over the DMZ dressed in South Korean uniforms. They attacked Blue House and came quite close to getting at Park Chung-hee. Also at the same time that year, they seized the Pueblo. I was in Tokyo at that time with CIA and was part of a task force designed to retaliate against the North Koreans. We looked at all options. We couldn't figure out anything to do that wouldn't have started a second Korean War, and so we sort of held our breath and backed off, and eventually the crew was returned. But the ship, as I said before, still sits along the bank of the Taedong River. Also in 1973, several tunnels under the DMZ were dug by the North Koreans to be used possibly as invasion routes if they were going to attack the North. And it was my job as head of intelligence in Korea to estimate what our chances were of holding off a North Korean attack. And there happened to be a general there named Jim Hollingsworth, with whom I had served in Vietnam just before going to Korea. And he was battle-hardened, foul-mouthed, and a great table pounder. And he would get the North Koreans up along the banks of the Noktong River and yell at them and say, "We're going to kill every SOB on the north shore of that river. Not one of them is going to get across." And the North Koreans loved it. And the South Koreans loved it. And when they'd all gone home, Hollingsworth would turn to me and say, "Jesus Christ, I wish I could believe what I'm telling them." And so in the 70s, it was not at all sure that we could hold Seoul against an invasion from the north. So when I went back as ambassador in 1989, that was the first question I asked. Can we hold Seoul if there's an attack from the north? And the answer at that point was yes, if there's good weather. And that meant that if there was good enough weather so that we could instantly respond with massive air attacks until we could get more troops on the ground, we could hold Seoul. But if the North Koreans attacked at a time where weather was bad and we could not hit North Korean invading forces with massive air power, our ability to hold Seoul would be very difficult. And even today, although the North Korean army is wearing out, their equipment is old, they still have massive artillery along the DMZ. They can fire 300,000 or 400,000 shells an hour into Seoul. They are known to have chemical weapons, warheads for their artillery, so that even 24 hours of fighting on the Korean Peninsula would be a nightmare, resulting in the death of tens or hundreds of thousands of Koreans in Seoul. So there's no way that North Korea can win a war, but if we are so stupid and they are so mutually stupid as to be provoked into an attack on the South, all of the progress that South Korea has made would go or would be jeopardized, and an awful lot of people would die in the city of Seoul. So the idea of another war on the Korean Peninsula is absolutely unthinkable to the South Koreans, because they know they suffered what happened from 1950 to 1953. And so when they hear us talking about a surgical strike against North Korea's Yongbyong nuclear facility, that really shivers their timbers, because they know that an attack of that sort would trigger some kind of large-scale military response from the north. So I'm one of those who believes that the threat of military force is terribly important if you're going to be successful in conducting diplomacy. But the threat of force is infinitely more effective than the use of force. Once you actually have to use force, you're in a completely different ball game where you're not at all sure how things are going to come out. When I went back to Seoul as ambassador, the South Koreans had a very important decision made in 1987, which allowed the direct election of the South Korean president, and democracy had really taken root. And we were increasingly concerned about North Korea's potential development of nuclear weapons. And at that time, we had nuclear weapons in South Korea. They were old, sort of iron bomb type things, developed during the Korean War and stored there, ever since. And, so one of the first things I encountered when I was ambassador was the annual inspection of our nuclear weapons by a team sent out from Washington. Because at one point in Spain, I believe, an American nuclear weapon had gone off accidentally, and the repercussions of that were tremendous. So There was an annual inspection devoted to seeing that we are keeping our nuclear weapons very safe. And we were. But in talking to the chief of the inspection team when he left, I said, why do we have these here? And he said, well, they've always been here. And I said, well, is that all you can say? And he said, yeah, they've always been here. So I then went to the commander of the U.S. forces, and I said, we're going to be putting pressure on North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. And they're going to say, well, why should we give up our nuclear weapons when you've got nuclear weapons in the South? This may be an incentive to Southern students to start demonstrating for the removal of nuclear weapons. And we never remove weapons under pressure. So I said, how about thinking about removing our nuclear weapons on our own initiative before anybody asks us to? And he said, well, that's an interesting question. And we started a dialogue. And within a couple of months, he came back and said, yeah, that's okay with the Pentagon. So I said, all right, now let's go to Blue House. So we went to the Korean president's former general named No Tae-woo. And after explaining to him that this was not in any way a weakening of U.S. support of South Korea, but a judicious step enabling us to take a stronger stand against development of nuclear weapons in North Korea, he agreed. And so in about a year after I arrived, I was able to send a message back to Washington saying, President No Tae-woo of South Korea and General Robert Riscasi, commander of the UN command, and I all recommend that all of our nuclear weapons be removed from South Korea. And I got one very short message back saying, you'll never know what a good message that was. That was all it said. And several months later, George Herbert Walker Bush, again the good Bush, announced that all nuclear weapons, of United States nuclear weapons, were being withdrawn from overseas countries, which I think was a tremendously positive move. The North and the South made quite a bit. Yes. 1991. We didn't admit it at the time because our thing was NCND, no comment, neither declare or deny NCND. But what we did was send a message to President No Tae-woo, and then he was able to say, I have been assured by the United States that all nuclear weapons have been removed. So that's the way it was handled. with that as a added incentive, North Korea became a little easier to approach. The South Korea had carried out a very skillful diplomatic campaign called Nordpolitik. It was based on Willy Brandt's campaign out of West Germany called Ostpolitik. And the United States helped South Korea gained political recognition from first the Soviet Union and then China and then virtually every country in Eastern Europe. And so during my time in Korea, the political isolation of North Korea was increased as they lost the sort of undivided attention of both the Soviet Union and the Chinese. There were prime ministerial level meetings between North and South Korea, and things were going quite well until people in the Pentagon and South Korean military, without consulting with me, reinstated an annual military exercise called Team Spirit, which the North Koreans detested. I had gotten them to cancel it for two previous years, and that had been taken by the North Korean as evidence of our real interest in improving relations. But the generals got together and said, oh, we really need this for training purposes. And so without my knowledge, it was reinstated. the North Koreans used that, they reacted very negatively to it. And a lot of the momentum which was achieved at that point was lost. I left Korea in just after Bill Clinton's election, and his national security advisor, a man named Kim Chung-hui, who'd been in Blue House for 5 years and was a tremendously helpful and intelligent person, he said, "I think if we could have had everybody stay in place for one more year, we could have reached a real accommodation with North Korea." But that did not happen. And in fact, in 1993, North Korea announced that they were pulling out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And by 1994, they were moving full steam ahead to develop at a place called Yongbyong, enriched plutonium for nuclear weapons. And Bill Clinton had a real crisis on his hands in 1994. My successor as ambassador, Jim Laney, felt that tension was so high in the peninsula that he was about to order all non-essential civilian people to leave Seoul. Now, when an ambassador does that, that is the last thing you do before going to war. But instead of that, he called up his old friend, Jimmy Carter. Ambassador Laney had been president of Emory University, lived in Atlanta, knew Carter very well. He knew Carter had a standing invitation to go to North Korea. And so Carter went to North Korea, met with Kim Il-sung, and Kim Il-sung said, "Well, hey, if what we're doing at Yongbyong bothers you, we'll shut it down. But I'll need some heavy oil to make up for the electric power generating potential of that nuclear reactor, and I'll ask you to build two light water nuclear reactors so that we eventually can have more access to clean power." And so that was the sort of the outline of an agreement signed in 1994, under which the plutonium approach to North Korean nuclear weapons was abandoned. The Republicans never liked that. They were anxious, I think, to use North Korea as a justification for national missile defense. Rumsfeld was author of a report in 1994 called "The Missile Threat to the United States," and North Korea was the number one threat listed there. Bill Clinton became more and more interested in trying to solve the North Korean issue, and he'd sent Bill Perry, a former Secretary of Defense, to North Korea to work on the nuclear program and the missile program, which North Korea was also involved in. Things progressed rather rapidly. The number two ranking man in North Korea was invited to the White House in the fall of 2000. He invited Bill Clinton to go to Pyongyang. Bill Clinton took that offer very seriously and took Madeleine Albright, told her to go check out North Korea and to see if it might be worth his going. And she went to North Korea, had about 11 hours with Kim Jong-il, but time ran out. And so Bill Clinton didn't go, and George W. Bush came in. And he took a much harder line toward North Korea. He did not take up where Bill Clinton left off. And in 2002, in his State of the Union speech, he fatefully declared the axis of evil with Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, which I think was one of the most unfortunate things that he did as president, and that's going some to say that. In the meantime, I'd come back here to run the Korea Society. I started that immediately after leaving South Korea, and I was both chairman and president of the Korea Society until a couple of months ago when Evans took my place, and I now have retired to the woods of Armonk and I'm doing some writing. And so I come in occasionally to speak to people like you. But I've been encouraged by President Kim Dae-jung to get the Korea Society interested and active with North Korea. As he said to me, "You call yourself the Korea Society, but you're really only dealing with the South Koreans. If you're to live up to the name of your society, you really have to get involved with the North." And so I took that very seriously, and we began to invite North Koreans to our home. And in 2002, I wrote a letter to Kim Jong-il, which I really sort of surprised myself when I think that I actually did it, but I was really compelled to do it. Nobody told me to do it. If I'd asked anybody if I should have done it, they would have said no. But I did, and I wrote to him, and I said, it's imperative that you talk directly with North Korea, with North Americans about your nuclear weapons program, because we've been attacked by terrorists who would love to get their hands on nuclear weapons. And there are those in the United States who are very fearful that what you're doing in the nuclear field could fall into terrorist hands, and we need at all costs to avoid that. And so I took it to a North Korean that I'd known here who worked in they have a UN mission. And I knew him quite well. We'd been out drinking together, and we were friends. And he read the letter, and this is a wonderful Korean reaction. He said, how dare you write a letter like that to my chairman? Who do you think you are? And I said, well, I said, I'm saying some things that I think your chairman needs to know. And I said, I think I know how his mind works, and I think he'd react positively to what I said. But how can you know how his mind works? And I said, well, I've talked to Chinese who were with him when he visited a Buick plant in Shanghai, and the Chinese heard him say to his staff, "This is the kind of thing we need to do in North Korea. We need to attract American investment." I've talked to a Russian diplomat named Tolaroya, who sat with him on the train for 3 or 4 days when he went by train to visit Putin in Moscow. And he doesn't like to fly, so he went by train. And this guy named Tolaroya said, I found him highly intelligent, quite funny, self-deprecating sense of humor. He asked very smart questions about what was going on in Russia. I've talked with Madeleine Albright about him. She had 11 hours of discussion with him. And as she puts it publicly, she said, well, Kim Jong-il and I have quite a lot in common. We're both about the same height. We both wear high heels, and we both put mousse in our hair. But she also has a lot of respect for the way his mind works. And then I didn't tell that particular anecdote to my North Korean friend, but I then went on to say I'd talked to Kim Dae-jung and many other South Koreans who'd been to the North. And he said, well, that's a good answer. I'll send your letter. And so 2 weeks later, I was invited to come. And so I notified the State Department of what I had done. And I sent them a copy of my letter. They sent a Korean-speaking Foreign Service officer along with me, which was very helpful. And so I went to Seoul. And my host there has always been Kim Gae-gwan, who's the head of the six-party talks. He's the man that Chris Hill deals with. And he asked me a great series of questions. He said, why is George W. Bush so different from his father? That was his first question. And I said, well, maybe it's because he was raised in Texas and his father was raised in New England. And then he said, how can you function as a country when one of your presidents is so different from the person who preceded him? And I said, well, you have what we might call continuity of leadership. We have elections, and that sometimes makes you deal with somebody who's quite different. But we, on the whole, think it's a very healthy process. But sometimes it brings about a marked change. And then he said, why don't you understand us better? And I said, well, I went into my you're the longest running failure in the history of American espionage line. And I could see him sort of swelling with pride. And I went on about that. And he said, are you wearing your op center hat when you say that? And I said, what? And he said, you heard me. Are you wearing your op center hat? I said, are you referring to a lousy book by Tom Clancy? He said, well, we don't think it was so lousy. But Clancy has written a series of books with a co-author named Steve Pachenik. And the first book in that series is called Op Center. And the central figure in that book is named Gregory Donald. And my name is Donald Gregg. And the man in that book started out as chief of station in Seoul and then went back as ambassador. And so there's a certain resemblance to me. And I got a lot of very amusing phone calls when that book came out about 10 years ago. And so I said, I'm really surprised that you guys have read that book. He said, of course we've read it. And I said, well, I haven't, but my wife has read it. And I said, would you like her reaction to it? And he said, yes. I said, well, she refers to it as an airport-only paperback. In other words, it's only something worth reading on a long aircraft ride. And then I said she really didn't mind the fact that I died an honorable death at the end of the book, but she was furious about the fact that I'd had a Korean mistress. And so that got a big laugh out of them. Now, I tell you that because the Koreans in the North are really not that different from the Koreans in the South. They have great senses of humor. They'll tell you exactly what they think of you. And if you deal with them straight, they'll deal with you straight. When I was ambassador, there was a place called Gwangju where there was a tremendous amount of resentment against us because of our supposed involvement in the crushing of an uprising in 1980. And I went down there and talked to a number of the people. We had a cultural center there, and it was actually being firebombed. And I talked to a number of the guys who were actually throwing the firebombs. And they had a massive case of Han. Now, I know you've been studying Korean, but I don't think you've gotten to the point where you're studying that word. But that's an important word to know. It's H-A-N, very simple. And it's a uniquely Korean word. And it means a sense of deep resentment against something that you feel has happened that should never have happened, that was unjustified. And so the South Koreans in Gwangju felt that our involvement in the massacre, which was not true, was absolutely unfair, unjustified. They had a great feeling of Han. So I went down and four times and talked to them. And as I talked to them, and they saw that I was trying my best to answer their questions, I could feel the feeling of Han begin to evaporate a little bit. And I found exactly the same pattern in North Korea. They have great resentments against us. They remember all of the things that I mentioned. They have in their history museum, they have a marvelous painting of the Sherman being burnt to the gunwales. They have an account of the Americans coming in and slaughtering the South Koreans in their mud forts. So they're fully aware of all the things we have done. And there's a lot of resentment on their part toward us. We flattened their country in World War II. And as I said, MacArthur wanted to drop nuclear weapons. So I've been there four times. And each time I go, I'm more warmly received. I haven't met Kim Jong-il, but I get up the food chain. I'm now up to about the number four or person in the North. And I feel very comfortable going there. I think that if we continue to negotiate sincerely and in a straightforward way, I think they are will be willing to give up their nuclear weapons, but only if they are sure that we do not have a secret plan to blow them out of the water. I think Chris Hill is doing a very fine job. I think he at last has the support of Secretary of State Rice. I think President Bush realizes that he could use some kind of a success in the foreign policy field before he leaves office. And I think he's correct in looking at the issues that he is dealing with, that North Korea, as difficult as it is far easier to deal with than the problems associated with terrorism and absolute fanaticism. Because the North Koreans are not fanatics. They are practical people. They want a stable relationship with the United States. In this room, on the 5th of March this year, Kim Gae-gwan, my host, sat here for 3 hours with Madeleine Albright and Henry Kissinger and other distinguished Americans, and the central theme was how to establish a strategic relationship between North Korea and the United States. That's what they want. And I think it's in our interest to have that come about, and I think we're on the way to achieving that. I don't think we're going to achieve it as long as George W. Bush is president. I think the North Koreans will make a certain amount of progress, but I doubt that they're going to do everything we want them to do until they are dealing with a new president. Why is that? Because they have learned that one American president can be very different from his predecessor. I think that they want to have some trust with George W. Bush when he leaves office and be able to carry that over to build additional trust with the next president. So I'm hopeful on the future of North-South relations on the Korean Peninsula. I have huge admiration for the Korean people. There was a statement by the parents of the 20 or 21 South Koreans being held by the Taliban still. It was sent to Bush and President Karzai of Afghanistan, and they said, we don't want to overturn world order or by our requests, but we still feel that the release of our children would be a way of demonstrating our concern for individuals and for humanity as a whole. And they are saying it isn't the United States who sent our children to Afghanistan. They went of their own volition, but please, can't you do something to save them? And they're doing it in a very, very grateful way, and it's a terrible situation for them, and I don't know what the end of that is going to be. So let me stop here and hope that I've provoked some questions, but thank you very much for your attention. I... Sir, Team Spirit was a big military exercise where we would send maybe 20,000 troops to Korea from Hawaii, from Panama, to conduct exercises with the South Koreans, pretending that the North had invaded the South. And so this was just a reminder to the North Koreans that if they attacked the South again, they were immediately going to have to contend with us, and they didn't like that, and they didn't like being reminded of it. Good question. I should have mentioned it. I don't think so. I think it's politically motivated. No Moo Hyun is not a very popular president in the South. I think by going to the North, I think he hopes to build up his own prestige. I think he hopes to build up the prestige of his party and his party's candidate in the presidential election, which comes up late this fall. The big question is, why is Kim Jong-il willing to meet with him? I think they would like to sort of increase their influence and standing with the South Koreans, and I think it's a good thing that it's happening. I don't think it's going to be terribly consequential. I hope that this decision was fully worked out with the American Department of State before it happened, and I hope very much that No Moo Hyun, when he goes to Pyongyang, will make it very clear that the first point that needs to be handled is North Koreans getting rid of their nuclear weapons before any other major issue can be decided. Yes. Well, the trigger factor was Team Spirit, which was really they did not like it, and they felt that it had undermined a lot of the things that we had done. President George W. Bush was elected Bill Clinton, I beg your pardon, was elected in the fall of 92, and there wasn't a particularly good carryover from Bush to Clinton, and so a lot of things, they didn't pay sufficient attention to what was going on. They pulled out of the NPT, they began to fire missiles, and it just got very quickly, the momentum was lost. Anything else? Yes. Yeah, we have about 30,000 troops. I'm not exactly sure what the level is. And we have the ability to, as long as the weather is good, to reinforce very quickly, particularly air. I think the chances of war breaking out on the Korean Peninsula is close to zero at this point, because all Koreans know what a disaster it would be. And we now, thanks to Chris Hill and thanks to people like Kim Gae-gwan and thanks to the help of the Chinese, who have been very helpful, we got a pretty good dialogue started with the North Koreans. And I think they realize that if they want to join the rest of the world and become really part of a very dynamic neighborhood, which is Northeast Asia, nuclear weapons are not the way to get there. No. No. Now, I think there's a real generational split in South Korea. The older people who remember the horrors of the Korean War, the North Koreans behaved very badly, very cruel, and they are still very grateful for Harry Truman making the decision to come in and stop the North Korean conquest. Younger people don't share that feeling. They don't remember the war. And in fact, there are those who say, and this was really surprising to me when I heard it, if you hadn't interfered in 1950, the war would have been over long ago. Yes, the North would have won, but we'd have sorted it out, and by now we'd be a unified, prosperous country. Now, that's tough for an American to hear when we think, 38,000 casualties in combat, but there are younger South Koreans who feel that. Yes. Do I have any predictions as to what will happen in North Korean politics? That's a very good and very tough question, because when Kim Il-sung was running North Korea, and he was the man who had come to power with the Soviets in 1948, he anointed his son, Kim Jong-il, as his successor a couple of decades before his death. And so it was very clear to every North Korean what would happen when Kim Il-sung died. And so there was tremendous mourning for him, but there was no uncertainty as to what was going to happen. Now, today, there's total uncertainty because Kim Jong-il has some children, but they haven't exactly distinguished themselves. One of them was caught in Japan trying to smuggle his family into the Japanese equivalent of Disneyland. And one of them is ambassador to, I think, Norway, but nobody knows what's going to happen when Kim Jong-il goes. And he's has some health issues, and that's an issue that the North Koreans just do not want to touch with a 10-foot pole. So you put your finger on a very dicey issue. Yes. Well, I think that Gary is a wonderful scholar, and I agree with that. My interpretation of what he is saying is that the only full-blown institution in North Korea is the military. And if the military decided to take over, there'd be nobody, if they were united in that, they could take over in a minute. So Kim Jong-il has had a military-first policy. He has continued to favor them in terms of resource allocation. While he was taking these sort of risky steps of meeting with Kim Dae-jung, the South Korean president, and allowing a dialogue with the United States to go on. So he's very anxious to keep the military happy while he moves in a direction which I think he feels can eventually lead to a more normal set of relations. But in terms of de facto power, in North Korea, the military is it. But they're basically anonymous men, and they are, you see them standing around Kim Jong-il. I mean, and they are not known by name to us, and they're not, they may be known in North Korea, but it is Kim Jong-il who is glorified by the North Korean media in their great mass games and so forth. So Gary is right that the military is the institution, but Kim Jong-il is the man. Yeah. Did you have your hand up? Yeah. Well, I think Gary probably knows more about the interplay of the among the top people than I do. And I have been I have met the three or four people who people say are the closest advisors to Kim Jong-il, and they're impressive people. And I hope he does. I hope he does listen to them, because they've had experience in the outside world more than he has. But Kim Jong-il reads the South Korean press on the internet every year, every day. He's encouraging an IT exchange program that the Korea Society is supporting between Syracuse University and Kimchek University. So I think he's willing to take some risks in order to change North Korea enough so that it can become a more normal, more modern country. And he's willing to take those risks. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed this, and I wish you well in your teaching, and thank you for what you're doing as teachers. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Quarterly. Memberships may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.